This episode features discussions of kidnapping and the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse of adults and children that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
It was May 2003. Ariel Castro opened Michelle Knight's bedroom door and introduced her to a petite blonde woman wearing a pair of boys' pajamas, who looked nothing short of terrified.
Ariel introduced her as his brother's girlfriend, but didn't give her name.
Michelle stayed quiet, muttering a quick hello, but inside she was screaming. She had endured 7 months of Ariel's continuous torture, and now he had captured a second girl.
Michelle was afraid for Amanda Berry, but she should have feared for herself. Little did she know that with Amanda's arrival would come a demotion. She thought he was a monster before. She had no idea.
This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can find episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Hostage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. So let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help.
This is our final episode on the decade-long abduction and imprisonment endured by three young women at the hands of Cleveland Public School bus driver Ariel Castro.
Last week, we followed 21-year-old Michelle Knight, who was kidnapped by Ariel Castro while on her way to a social services appointment. She spent the next 6 months chained to a radiator. She was beaten, assaulted, starved, and kept in squalid conditions.
7 months into her kidnapping, Ariel told Michelle that he was looking for another girl, this time a pretty blonde.
This week, we'll recount the abductions of 16-year-old Amanda Berry and 14-year-old Gina De Jesus, and the 10 long years the three women spent as Ariel's captives.
In April of 2003, 21-year-old Michelle Knight was watching the news in her room on the little TV that Ariel had given her a few weeks prior.
In the 7 months since her abduction, things had improved dramatically. She was no longer chained to a radiator or pole in the basement. In fact, she finally had her own bedroom.
But she knew better than to trust Ariel Castro's good mood. Her 42-year-old captor was a madman who had recently told Michelle that he was on the hunt for a new girl, a blonde instead of a brunette.
And by the looks of it, he'd found her.
A news headline flashed across her TV screen, announcing the disappearance of Amanda Berry a day before her 17th birthday. Michelle's stomach turned as she prepared herself to meet her new roommate.
16-year-old Amanda Berry clocked out of her last shift at the local Burger King at 7:36 p.m. on April 21st, 2003.
Amanda was extraordinarily bright, so much so that instead of attending the local high school, she was self-teaching her way through an advanced placement homeschool curriculum and earning top marks.
Amanda was close with her older sister Beth and her mother, Luana. The three were a tight-knit family unit.
In fact, she was on the phone with Beth as she walked home from work that evening. They were so engrossed in conversation, she barely noticed that a maroon van had slowed down while passing her.
She only looked up when the van made a U-turn, then parked in front of her.
Amanda didn't recognize the driver initially, He introduced himself as Ariel Castro, Angie's dad. She needed a ride home, so when he offered, she agreed wholeheartedly. She told her sister she'd call her back and hopped in the van.
When the pair arrived at 2207 Seymour Avenue, Angie was nowhere to be found. Ariel said she was taking a bath. In the meantime, he could give her a quick tour of the home.
This was how he was able to lure Amanda to the upstairs bedroom, a dark, sparsely furnished room that would soon become her dungeon.
Once there, Ariel quickly overpowered Amanda, muffling her cries while he sexually assaulted her for the first time. He bound her with duct tape, put a motorcycle helmet over her head, and carried her downstairs to the basement, where he chained her around the waist to a support pole in the middle of the room.
The initial weeks were nothing short of a living hell. When not keeping her in the bedroom on the second floor, Ariel would drag Amanda to the basement every few hours to brutalize her. He also began starving her, much as he had done to Michelle.
According to science writer and health editor Mark Lyonia, starvation can be an effective tool in keeping a prisoner docile. Even though hunger pangs subside after a few days, the prisoner will become dizzy, sluggish, and may suffer from a loss of coordination.
Over time, they will likely suffer neurological problems like cognitive impairment, apathy, and loss of motor skills. In starving Amanda, Ariel was ensuring that she would be easier to keep captive.
Eventually, Ariel let Amanda sit with him in the living room and watch news reports about her disappearance. Amanda saw her mother and sister pleading for her safe return and began to sob.
Ariel looked to her and said, "Your mom looks really upset," as casually as if he was commenting on the weather.
Ariel delighted in the misery he was causing. One day, he told Amanda he'd use her cell phone to call her mother and told her that the two of them were in love and getting married, that Amanda was safe, and that they could stop looking for her.
He even made Amanda listen to some of the voicemails left by frantic loved ones begging her to come home. It was impossibly cruel.
A few days later, in mid-April 2003, she sat in her dark, dank bedroom upstairs and heard Ariel coming down the hallway. She braced herself for whatever horror he brought with him.
Instead, he brought a small TV so that she could watch the news.
Amanda was utterly confused. She clung to hope by telling herself that each day just got her closer to going home. She wasn't going to die alone in this house.
Of course, she had no idea that she wasn't alone. Just down the hallway, another woman was sitting in an equally dark room in silence, mourning the loss of her recently confiscated TV.
The TV had been Michelle Knight's lifeline to the rest of the world. She had been watching it when Ariel came into her room and confirmed her deepest fear. He had kidnapped another woman and wanted to introduce them.
Michelle had flown off the handle, enraged that Ariel had done this to another girl. To retaliate, Ariel took Michelle's TV and gave it to Amanda.
Ariel soon returned with a different TV, which barely worked. He made it clear that Amanda deserved the better one, as she was going to be his wife.
Whether he knew it or not, Ariel was creating a hierarchy between these two women, one that would later have devastating psychological effects on Michelle.
In early May 2003, Michelle and Amanda met for the first time. Michelle uttered a quick hello. Then Ariel ferreted Amanda back to her own room, locking her in chains. He did the same to Michelle.
Michelle wouldn't see Amanda for months after that, but she could hear her old TV playing in Amanda's room. It sparked a kernel of animosity towards this new woman in the house, the woman Ariel clearly preferred.
It may seem nonsensical, but the resentment Michelle felt was real.
Well, this was only compounded by the fact that Ariel was singling Michelle out for particularly heinous abuse and blaming it on Amanda. Ariel would force himself on Michelle and tell her it was because Amanda didn't want him that night.
Or he would explore the depths of his depravity with Michelle and tell her that he didn't want to subject Amanda to these acts since she was the woman he was going to marry.
Michelle never blamed Amanda for this deviant behavior, but it was hard not to resent the preferential treatment Amanda received. Michelle found herself embittered towards a woman that she also needed to survive.
In a moment, Michelle's relationship with Amanda is complicated by unexpected news and Ariel's even more unexpected reaction.
Now, back to the story.
In the days after Amanda Berry's initial disappearance on April 21st, 2003, her mother, Luana, and sister, Beth, worked tirelessly to locate her, but they ran into obstacles at every turn.
Police initially believed Amanda to be a runaway and didn't put legwork into locating her. They believed she was likely just with her boyfriend.
Luana and Beth created missing person flyers and taped them up all over town, which helped generate leads. But unfortunately, so many of the leads were false that the police began ignoring them and focusing their investigation on Amanda's boyfriend, DJ.
Well, then, a week after Amanda disappeared, the family received a call from her cell phone.
But it wasn't their daughter on the line. It was a man whose voice Luana didn't recognize. The man said, "I have Mandy. She wants to be here because we are married. But I'll have her back home in a couple of weeks."
Luana begged for the man to release her daughter, but he hung up without another word.
Luana was devastated. The phone call had confirmed her worst fears. Someone had abducted Amanda. She called FBI Special Agent Robert Hawk, who had been put in charge of the investigation, with the lead.
It took 6 months for the FBI to admit the call wasn't a hoax, announcing to Cleveland newspaper The Plain Dealer that they believed the call to Luana had come from the kidnapper.
The investigation stalled. Leads were few and far between. Finding Amanda was like finding a needle in a haystack. She had quite literally disappeared.
Well, their only hope was that the kidnapper would use Amanda's phone again, in which case they could track its location and pounce.
FBI agents fanned out across Cleveland, staking out the neighborhood, praying for a call. Agents would later discover that one van was stationed a mere 1,000 feet from where Amanda and Michelle were held captive.
Although the FBI had no idea Michelle Knight was also captive, there had barely been an investigation into her disappearance. Her family believed her a runaway, and just as the search for Amanda was heating up, Michelle was taken off of the missing persons registry.
Not that it made much of a difference. After 8 days without a phone ping, the FBI concluded that Amanda's phone must have died, and they called it quits.
Amanda Berry's case went cold. Ariel evaded the law. Although he did have a close call in January 2004, nearly a year after Amanda had been kidnapped and 20 months after Michelle Knight's abduction.
Ariel, who was still a bus driver for Cleveland Public Schools, was tasked with picking up two children on their way to a special program that treated their attention deficit disorder at Wade Park Elementary.
Well, Ariel dropped one of the children off at his intended destination, but for whatever reason, did not escort the second boy off the bus. Instead, he drove the second boy to a Wendy's, where he made the boy wait in the back of the bus while he ate, then drove around for a few hours. The second boy did eventually get home all right, without any evidence of sexual abuse, but the entire incident was odd, disturbing, and completely nonsensical. The boy's parents were upset, and Cleveland Public Schools launched an investigation.
As part of the investigation, two Cleveland police officers showed up at 2207 Seymour to talk with Ariel about his conduct. Of course, Ariel didn't answer the door, and even though Amanda was home at the time, she didn't hear the knocking.
Ariel would blast the radio in the upstairs hallway to drown out noise both trickling into the house and out of it. The police left 2207 Seymour shortly after, never to return again. Castro was suspended from bus driving for 60 days, but otherwise, nothing came of the very bizarre incident.
It might seem incredible that police never spoke to Ariel Castro about the incident face to face, but in fact, they had followed protocol to the letter. Nothing required them to follow up. The single attempt was enough.
Of course, had they been required to enter Ariel's home, they likely would have discovered the captives upstairs. But from the police's perspective, the two-hour kidnapping was a singular incident on an otherwise spotless record.
If anything, this spurs the need for policy reform within law enforcement, as it ignores red flags of escalating behavior. According to the case study, Psychosocial Influences of the Escalation of Deviance, published by the U.S. National Library of Medicine, prior studies conducted in 1982, 1988, 1995, and 2003 all concluded that deviant criminal behavior escalates over a lifetime, and that nonviolent crimes, like Ariel's mini-kidnapping, are very likely to escalate as the criminal gains confidence. Identifying these kinds of crimes as warning signs instead of isolated incidents is a key component to intervening with career criminals.
A few months later, on April 2, 2004, 14-year-old Gina De Jesus called her mother Nancy from a payphone near school.
She was hanging out with her friend, Arlene Castro, Ariel's daughter. Gina wanted Arlene to come spend the night at her house.
While Nancy De Jesus approved of the sleepover, Arlene's mother, Nilda, said no. She needed Arlene to come home. The girls were disappointed and soon went their separate ways.
As Gina began her walk home, however, she noticed Ariel Castro waving at her from his Jeep Cherokee. He asked if she knew where Arlene was. Gina pointed in the opposite direction and said she had headed home.
Instead of driving off, Ariel asked if Gina would help him find her.
Gina knew to be wary of strangers, but Ariel Castro wasn't a stranger. He was Arlene's dad and a school bus driver. She got in the Jeep.
But instead of driving in the direction that Gina had pointed, Ariel started driving the opposite way.
He explained it was just a quick detour. He had money at his house that he needed to give to Arlene. His reasoning struck Gina as strange, but she tried not to listen to the knot forming in her stomach. This was her friend's dad. Everything would be fine.
The Jeep Cherokee pulled into the driveway at 2207 Seymour Avenue. Gina intended to wait in the Jeep, but Ariel asked her to help him carry a speaker in the house back to the car.
It's easy to judge the small, 5-foot-tall girl for believing such a lie, but Gina felt pressure to help her friend's dad. She worried that if she wasn't nice, word would get back to her mom. She could upset Arlene.
Gina had some learning challenges and was in a special education program at school. While it might seem clear that Ariel was tricking Gina, the pressure she felt in the moment, combined with her atypical learning style, made it difficult for her to identify why she felt nervous. She agreed to help. Gina hopped out of the Jeep and followed Ariel into the dilapidated house.
Inside, Gina had to work not to throw up. The house smelled of urine and mold and was littered with McDonald's wrappers. The sight of it made her sick.
Ariel asked her to sit at the kitchen table, take her coat off, and get comfortable. He'd grab the money and speaker.
Instead, moments later, he tried to grope her. Gina went berserk, demanding to go home. She started walking towards the front door, but Ariel stopped her. He told her the way out of the house was different from the way in.
Ariel led Gina to the basement door, making like it was the way out. Instead, he flung the door open, shoved her down the few steps into the basement, then flew after her, pinning her to the damp concrete floor by sitting on her.
Gina kicked and thrashed, trying to wrest free from under Ariel's weight. But Gina was tiny. Ariel was easily twice her size. He waited until she began to tire herself out before asking, "Are you done?"
Gina was desperate. In a moment of quick thinking, she went limp, as though she was too tired to keep fighting. Satisfied, Ariel got up to fetch his chains. When he did so, Gina bolted up the stairs.
But Ariel had anticipated the break and grabbed her, pulling her back into the basement. He slammed her against the pole and bound her neck and waist with chains. He also bound her hands behind her back and muzzled her with a filthy rag and length of rope. Gina sobbed, gasping for breath.
Meanwhile, upstairs, Michelle Knight heard the racket and wondered what had happened. She would soon get her answer.
Later that night, on the barely functioning television in her room, she saw a news report of the disappearance of 14-year-old Gina De Jesus, who had disappeared mere blocks from where Michelle and Amanda had been taken.
As the news report ended, Michelle could hear screams echoing from the basement. She felt sick. They had a new prisoner.
Gina had been lying on the dank basement floor for days. Finally, Ariel brought her a thin twin mattress to sit on and a little bit of fast food from McDonald's. It was all he ever fed them.
A month after her capture, Ariel started asking Gina if she was a virgin. Gina understood what was coming next and felt sick. Her thoughts turned to her mother, who she prayed would come save her.
As Gina suspected, Nancy De Jesus was frantic. By 8 p.m. on the night of Gina's disappearance, Nancy and Gina's father, Felix, had rallied as many family members and friends as they could and began combing the streets of their neighborhood, looking for Gina.
Police had already come and gone, brushing off Gina's disappearance as a runaway. But Nancy knew her daughter. She knew she'd never leave home.
It wasn't until Saturday, April 3rd, that Police Lieutenant Marge Laskowski followed up with Nancy. She had worked a lot with runaway cases in her career, but this one seemed different.
This was in part due to Detective Brian Heffernan, who worked on Amanda Berry's case. Detective Heffernan noted the similarities and the proximity between the abduction points.
He and Detective Laskowski suspected they were dealing with a serial abductor. They immediately alerted the FBI.
By noon, the media had swarmed Gina's house. Reporters were raising the possibility that Amanda and Gina's abductions were related. Within 48 hours, the story was a national headline. Police conducted a series of interviews and requested security footage from the cameras at her school to scout for anything suspicious.
Unfortunately, the cameras weren't working that day. Had they been, police would have seen Ariel Castro walk into the building and begin talking to a security guard.
But Ariel was a school bus driver, so none of this seems suspicious. He belonged at the school. So much so that the security guard didn't even remember to tell police about speaking with Ariel during his interview. Nothing about it had seemed strange. In August of 2004, Ariel introduced Gina and Michelle and told them they were going to be roommates.
He then chained both of them to the same bed, where they would remain off and on for almost a year.
The first night, Gina and Michelle stayed up until daybreak, sharing stories of the abduction and abuse they had suffered since arriving. They took solace in having one another.
As we've discussed, Michelle, by far, received the worst treatment of all three girls. But when she was chained to Gina 24 hours a day, Ariel eased up on Michelle. He would still sexually assault both women, even while they were tied to one another, but he couldn't throw Michelle down the stairs anymore. Not unless he also wanted to hurt Gina.
By the summer of 2004, Michelle had been captive for 2 years, Amanda for one and Gina for a few months. And for unknown reasons, Ariel surprised the captives with a visit from his 3-year-old grandson. He ordered the women to hide their chains and brought in his grandson to meet them. The grandson immediately started crying, and Ariel whisked him off back downstairs to his mother, Angie. It's unclear whether the women knew Angie was in the house or whether they were too scared to scream for help.
A few weeks later, Ariel took all three captives to the basement and chained them to a pole. It was the first time Amanda and Gina were in the same room, although Michelle had told Gina all about Ariel's wife down the hall.
But the women had no time to exchange pleasantries. Ariel put duct tape over their mouths and threatened to shoot them if they made a sound. Soon after, they heard voices upstairs, including the babblings of his toddler grandson. They heard members of Ariel's family demanding to see what was in the basement.
Michelle heard a woman, perhaps Angie, demanding Ariel open the basement door. She was too scared to make a peep, but she prayed the woman got her way. All three women waited with bated breath as the argument raged on upstairs.
Ariel insisted there was nothing downstairs except a floor filled with water and some projects he was working on. Eventually, the argument died down. Michelle could hear footsteps traveling out of the kitchen and disappearing. Then everything went silent.
Their lifeline had left the house. No one called the police. Nothing came of the surprise interrogation.
Ariel kept his captives in the basement for a few weeks, just in case his daughter returned with reinforcements, but she never did. Michelle, Amanda, and Gina realized that they were once again at Ariel's mercy as any shred of hope deflated.
A few weeks later, in late 2004, Ariel brought the women back upstairs to their bedrooms. For whatever reason, he started to loosen their chains and would even let them move around in the kitchen. Gina was allowed to cook breakfast for the household as Michelle and Amanda watched.
It became something of a daily routine, the dysfunctional unit eating breakfast together. Amanda was made to sit next to Ariel, who called her his wife. He would nuzzle up next to her and whisper sweet nothings in her ear, clearly believing their relationship to be both consensual and normal. He tried to keep her separate from Michelle and Gina, who he viewed as concubines.
This hierarchy was responsible for one of the most heartbreaking aspects of the women's captivity. In the first few years of her imprisonment, Michelle became pregnant 4 times. On all 4 occasions, Ariel beat and starved Michelle, sometimes throwing her down the stairs until she miscarried. It was not only gruesome and physically painful, it left Michelle emotionally devastated. It made her think of her son Joey, who was just 2 years old when she was abducted. She wondered if he missed her or even remembered her. The thought of it made her want to curl up and vanish.
The overwhelming loss and grief hit a fever pitch in March 2006. Michelle had been watching the news in her bedroom and learned that Luana Berry had died after being hospitalized with pancreatitis. Michelle's stomach dropped. She knew she was the one who would have to break the news to Amanda.
And as could be expected, Amanda was devastated. Overcome with grief, she began to throw up and was in hysterics for the rest of the day.
But the next morning, Amanda continued to vomit. Michelle felt sick herself as she realized Amanda wasn't just grieving. She was pregnant.
All three women prepared for Ariel to beat Amanda, much as he had done to Michelle. But to their surprise, he didn't. Rather, Ariel was elated to learn that his wife was with child.
Michelle knew she shouldn't resent Amanda, but she couldn't help it. A small part of her hated that Amanda would get to keep her baby when she'd been forced to miscarry all of hers.
She knew these feelings were childish, and she pushed them out of her mind as best she could. Instead, she focused her energy on making Amanda's life better. They were bringing a new life into the world. Michelle was dead set on making it the best world possible.
In a moment, Amanda brings a baby girl into the world, as matters only get worse for Michelle. Now back to the story.
On Christmas Eve, 2006, Ariel Castro woke his captive, Michelle Knight, and told her he needed help. Her fellow captive, Amanda Berry, was in labor. He had brought a kiddie pool into Amanda's room and put it on the mattress. He and Michelle then helped Amanda into the pool, where she laid for hours, fighting through the pain of labor. Ariel told Michelle to help Amanda deliver the baby, warning her that if it didn't come out alive, he'd kill her.
Finally, in the early morning on Christmas Day, Amanda gave birth. But her child was blue and wasn't breathing. Frantic, Michelle tipped the baby girl's head back and administered CPR. Ariel loomed over her, urging her to save the baby.
Finally, after what seemed like minutes, the baby cried and began to turn pink. That evening, as Amanda slept, Ariel brought the baby to Michelle and Gina and told them to care for her. Ariel was a proud new father, but clearly had no intentions of parenting.
Gina and Michelle were happy to care for the new baby, but despite her joy, Michelle couldn't help but think of her own son, Joey. The newborn's cries were both music to her ears and a wrench around her heart.
Amanda named the baby girl Jocelyn Jade Berry, but wasn't allowed to use the name in the house, instead calling her only by the name Pretty. She became the light in a world of darkness. As Jocelyn grew, she would waddle between Amanda and Michelle's bedrooms, and all three women mothered her as best they could.
Over the next 3 years, as Jocelyn began to pull on the women's chains and ask questions, Ariel also began to unlock the three women for longer periods of time and allow them to play with Jocelyn in the kitchen.
When Jocelyn was about 3 in 2010, Ariel started taking her to church every Sunday because it was important to him that his daughter grew up religious. The irony is appalling. How could he feel righteous when he had captives in his home who had been prisoners for up to 7 years already?
It was also around this time that Ariel began bringing Jocelyn to rehearsals for the rock band he played bass for. He would tell his bandmates she was his girlfriend's daughter.
The household of 5 settled into a disturbing but otherwise steady routine. Ariel would take Jocelyn on outings around town, and the three women would care for Jocelyn when she was home.
They lived like this for the next 3 or so years.
On Christmas Day, 2012, they even had a little birthday party for Jocelyn. She was turning 6, and Ariel bought her balloons and a birthday cake. However, Michelle wasn't allowed to celebrate with the rest of them. Instead, she was kicked down the basement stairs and forced to listen as everyone else enjoyed cake.
It was during this party, while she was lying on the cold, damp cement floor, that Michelle began to miscarry her 5th and final pregnancy.
5 months later, on May 6th, 2013, 10 years into Amanda Berry's captivity, Amanda awoke to hear her daughter Jocelyn running up and down the hallway. Her ears perked up when she registered what Jocelyn was saying.
The 6-year-old was shouting, Daddy's gone. Daddy's gone. It was then that Michelle realized Jocelyn was running in and out of their bedrooms while Ariel wasn't home. The doors were unlocked.
Amanda sprung up from her bed and poked her head into the hallway. Quietly, she moved downstairs and realized that Ariel's car was gone. He had indeed left them unchained.
She knew she had but a moment to spare. Amanda lunged at the front door and discovered the inner door was unlocked, although the outer door was chained shut.
She thrust her arm through a tiny hole in the door and began waving it frantically, screaming for help.
Charles Ramsey was in his home across the street. When he heard the screaming, he came outside to investigate. He and another neighbor saw Amanda, who was frantically flagging them down.
The two men raced over and helped her kick a hole in the door large enough for her to escape. She grabbed her daughter and fled across the street to another neighbor's house, where she was able to call the police.
Meanwhile, Gina and Michelle were still at 2207 Seymour, too scared to come out of their room, especially once they heard heavy knocking on the door and boots stomping up the stairs.
Michelle told Gina to stay quiet. After enduring 11 years of torture, she wasn't going to be shot in a home invasion gone awry. They'd wait for the robbers to leave.
Then she heard a woman cry out, "Police, anybody in here?" Michelle could hardly believe it. She cracked her bedroom door open and saw two police officers standing at the end of the hallway, shiny badges pinned to their chest.
Michelle had never known such relief. She leapt into the police officer's arms and hugged her so tightly, the officer began choking. The police led Michelle and Gina outside. And for the first time in 11 years, Michelle felt the sun on her face.
By the time Michelle was rescued, she was so battered she was tender to the touch and weighed only 84 pounds. She was so emaciated and small, the police initially thought she was a child. They were horrified to realize she was a 32-year-old woman.
The women received an outpouring of love from the community as their hospital rooms were filled with cards, balloons, and all manner of treats. Clevelanders banded together to raise money to cover the women's medical expenses and aid them in their recovery.
But all this cause for celebration was tempered somewhat as Michelle learned that her family had scarcely looked for her after she went missing and had allowed her son Joey to be adopted by another family.
She cut off all contact with them and sought recovery in private. To date, she has no contact with her relatives.
Ariel Castro was ultimately charged with 997 criminal charges, including 500 counts of kidnapping, 446 counts of rape, 3 counts of child endangerment, 2 counts of aggravated murder in regards to Michelle's miscarriages, and 1 count of possession of a criminal weapon.
During sentencing, he tried to explain to the judge that he was sick, that he was addicted to porn and sex, and had suffered childhood abuse. Because of this, he too was a victim.
The judge didn't buy it. Ariel was sentenced to life in prison plus 1,000 years.
On August 7th, 2013, 2207 Seymour Avenue was demolished. Police found $22,000 in cash in the house. It was offered to Gina, Michelle, and Amanda, but they each turned it down.
A month after that, in September 2013, Ariel Castro was found dead in his jail cell. He had died of hanging, although it's unclear whether this was suicide or an accident as a result of autoerotic asphyxiation.
Michelle Knight ultimately chose to rename herself Lily Rose Lee. In 2016, she met the love of her life, Miguel Rodriguez, The pair are now married.
Gina De Jesus, now 29, works with the Northeast Ohio Amber Alert Committee. She is determined to help others overcome their own personal struggles and regain a sense of joy in their lives.
For Amanda Berry, the road to recovery proved difficult. She said that for months, it felt as though everything she did was wrong, that she was constantly in trouble just for going outside or running to the store. Her entire perspective had been warped.
PTSD survivor Jenny Schaefer wrote about her own personal recovery for the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. Her experience sheds light on what Amanda Berry may have been going through.
Schaefer describes post-traumatic stress disorder as an invisible monster, which tells you that you are not safe, will never be safe, and should give up. In the wake of trauma, she was consumed by anxiety and depression. She suffered from flashbacks, nightmares, and bouts of rage, seemingly unprovoked by what was happening around her. The recovery process took years, and for Schaefer, is still ongoing.
Much of Amanda's writing about her experience reflects these feelings and helps us understand why she still struggles to feel safe. Amanda and Gina wrote a memoir together, which helped Amanda contextualize much of her experience, aiding in her own recovery.
Despite her struggles, Amanda has proved to be a model parent. Her daughter, Jocelyn, is thriving. Jocelyn is a happy preteen and takes after her mother scholastically.
Today, despite their harrowing ordeal, all three women have found joy in their lives and work to give back to the community that supported them after their rescue. They lost a decade of freedom, but work to make up for lost time by helping other survivors. In the years since their rescue, they have touched more lives than many do in a lifetime.
Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all your favorite Parcast originals, like Hostage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Hostage on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler and is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carrie Murphy, Maggie Admire, and Travis Clark. This episode of Hostage is written by Kenyetta Raylan and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.